Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris, and today our special guest is Robert Hockett. Robert teaches financial and business law subjects at Cornell Law School, where his research and writing focus on the legal and institutional prerequisites to a just and prosperous economic order. He is also a fellow at the Century Foundation, a commissioned author for the New America Foundation, and consultant to a number of financial institutions, regulators, and legislators. Prior to entering legal academia, he worked at the International Monetary Fund and served as a judicial clerk for the Honorable Donnell Reese Tacha, Chief Judge of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Tenth Circuit. He was educated at the University of Kansas, Oxford University, where he studied as a Rhodes Scholar, and Yale University. Robert also authored a memorandum entitled It Takes a Village, Municipal Condemnation Proceedings and Public-Private Partnerships for Mortgage Loan Modification, Value Preservation, and Economic Recovery. And it's that memorandum that we'll be speaking with him today. Robert, we're back on the air for this week's segment, and we're talking about the concept of eminent domain, specifically as it has to do with San Bernardino. And we had just talked about some of the court cases. And I wanted to touch bases with a court case that happened in Hawaii. Midkiff was the case, and it was in 1984. And there the owners, I guess there was just a few owners of land in Hawaii. And yeah. if you can take it from there, what was the reasoning behind the action? And
So the basic idea in Midkiff, in one respect, it's quite different from what San Bernardino is contemplating, again, because this was about, you know, forced sales of actual real properties, right, rather than mortgage loans. But the basic idea behind Midkiff is an idea that's sort of interesting for present purposes. And it was this. Hawaii sort of recognized that most of its residential real estate was owned by a relatively few people, right, a small number of established families who typically had some kind of lineal connections to the old royalty of the old independent Hawaiian kingdom before the U.S. Made a state of it. And so in that sense, Hawaii had kind of feudal, if I can put it that way, F-E-U-D-A-L, patterns of land ownership. And that meant, of course, that the overwhelming majority of Hawaiian citizens had to be renters, right? They were in that sense, they were like sharecroppers.
That's why I wanted to clarify. Palm Springs would be a perfect example where somebody owns a structure. They happen to be on leased land.
Right.
So they own the house, but they're renting the dirt. That's kind of what we're talking about in Hawaii, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's certainly close enough for present purposes. And Hawaii thought it would be actually better, as a matter of public policy, if the state of Hawaii were a bit more like the other states of the Union, all of those on the mainland, in this connection, right, for these purposes. So the thought was, it's better if the majority or the greater part of our citizens, at least those who can afford to do so, own their land and their houses outright in the way that most Americans do, right? We're sort of a settler society rather than a hacienda or plantation society. And Hawaii looked a good, you know, another way of putting this, if I can use language from the previous presidential administration, Hawaii thought America is kind of an ownership society by and large. But in Hawaii, we've got a kind of renter society or a leasership society or something, again, more like a kind of hacienda culture or plantation culture than an actual sort of settler society where people kind of own their own land and houses. And so I thought, first of all, that would be better as a public policy matter, and it kind of coheres with the classic sort of civic republican ideals that animate the American political experience and history. The other thing is, you know, more prosaically speaking, the thought was that if a relatively small number of people own all of this land, there are significant antitrust concerns, right, sort of market concentration or market power concerns, which is apt in the longer term, of course, to raise the prices of certain bits of land or leaseholds unnaturally, right? So Hawaii thought, okay, what we ought to do then is we'll pay fair value for this land that is concentrated in very few hands. So we're not just going to take it away in the way that, I don't know, it might be done in, say, Venezuela or something. We're going to pay for it. That's, of course, the Anglo-American way. But we're nevertheless going to do it because there is this significant public purpose. And that's, of course, what Hawaii did, and it was upheld, right? This was another legitimate exercise of the eminent domain authority.
Okay, now this is their stated purpose, if you will, and this is from your report. Reduce the concentration of ownership of fee simple interest, which was responsible for skewing the state's residential fee simple markets, inflating land prices, and injuring public tranquility and welfare.
Right.
Okay, are you aware what happened to prices after they accomplished that in 1984?
Well, I'm sure you're going to tell me.
Yeah, they doubled from 84 to 89, from 118 to 245.
Yeah,
and I guess that's my point, is that to me, the wrong money, or the money that came about, 1984 came off of 3 years of very high interest, a very bad recession,
sure.
And these people were forced to sell their land in an equivalent year of like 2012.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then the benefit went to the people that were able to get the forced result. They owned the land, but it did nothing to prevent inflating of land.
Right.
And it didn't help injure the public tranquility and welfare. So
right.
There's a case that I'm sure the intention was good, but it did exactly the opposite. Because when you turn leasehold interest land into fee simple land, you have a plethora of lenders all of a sudden that'll be willing to loan on it and much more interest in it. So it accomplished just the opposite, is my point.
Yeah, and that's a very important point. It can also be connected up with what happened in Kilo, right? So, you know, the promised economic revitalization of the city of New London that the city of New London asserted would occur if the particular taking in Kilo was upheld by the Supreme Court, of course, also didn't occur, right? And what's more, of course, Pfizer left very shortly after arriving. And so that ended up being a bit of a boondoggle as well. So that's not uncommon. But what it does is it highlights a particularly important point here, and I think it's this. There is, on the one hand, the legal question of, you know, when is an exercise of the eminent domain authority legitimate and permissible by constitutional rights. The other question, of course, is when is it good policy, right? When is it wise policy? So on the legal side first, the courts aren't there to sort of pass judgment on whether the policy is wise or not. What they are there to pass judgment on is whether there is a plausible public purpose that is articulated, that can be viewed as underlying the particular exercise of the eminent domain authority on the one hand, and then, of course, whether a fair price is paid on the other hand. And, of course, for every story where you've got a case where the public purpose turns out not to, or the policy turns out not to have been a good idea after all, you've got countless other cases where the policy does turn out to have been a good idea. And what the court's concerned about is not so much the sort of 20/20 hindsight that we have in respect of every particular case as to whether it was a good policy or not. It's basically concerned with what do you do looking forward. So is the case that the state of Hawaii made in 1984 a plausible case that this was indeed a public purpose and that indeed it's going to pay fair value, right? Likewise, the Supreme Court in Kilo wasn't going to say, okay, look, how certain is it that New London is going to be economically revitalized? The question was, is it plausible that it might and that this might be prompting this particular exercise of the eminent domain authority? And that's essentially the standard. And so the legal standard is much easier to meet, maybe not surprisingly, than is the standard that all of us apply when making policy judgments about particular exercises of eminent domain, you know, with hindsight, right? That might take us to the policy wisdom or otherwise of what San Bernardino is contemplating, and I'm happy to talk about that too if you'd like.
Yeah.
But I think you have another question here.
No, that's okay. I just want to make sure we have time to certainly do that.
Sure, sure.
Now, my feeling would be, and I had mentioned this in the first segment, that all the things that you talked about were in full bloom 2007, 2008, when foreclosures were extremely high.
Yeah.
And, of course, it took values down of properties that were current, non-current, everything in sight took it down. Now, but now I guess my question is, do you think things are getting better or worse?
Things do not appear to be getting better in the Inland Empire region and in various other parts of the country, right?
So, well, since I sell properties here, that's, you know, honestly, I would really respectfully disagree. And it, but yeah. But I'll just give you, and I'm not trying to be argumentative, and I just want you to realize that the market is certainly, it's been getting better. But I think your concern is not so much how things appear to be, but you're really talking about shadow inventory that we've yet to see. I think that's really where your legitimate concern is, that you haven't seen what could potentially show up.
Right. I guess, you know, I'll have to defer to you on, you know, sort of conditions on the ground in San Bernardino and thereabouts.
It's just that the inventory, I'll give you very specific so you can have, you know, that kind of to bounce off of.
Right.
Inventory basically is down from 5.7 months to 3.5.
Uh-huh.
And so you have, you know, probably a 40% reduction in inventory. And when you have something, and this is one of your statements in the seminar, and that's why, or in the memorandum, and why I asked if there was anything that you would probably change. It's just, again, you probably have to be in the business to really feel this.
Right.
But there's really very little for sale. And so when someone has a foreclosure, one of your statements was there's really very interest in it. You know, once the lender forecloses, that's completely changed to where now it's very likely that within the first day, they'll get 50 to 100 offers on almost anything that has a front door.
I see.
So the demand is so strong that that's why this plan seems to be talking about something that would have been more able to be understood in 08 as opposed to 2012.
Right. So I guess it's sort of, again, two replies. I mean, one is it's probably better to have that debate on those particulars with the city of San Bernardino or with the JPA forum thereby, because you guys are, you know, on the ground every day over there, and
right.
I'm not. I'm
okay.
Over here in New York. So that's the first point. Second point, I guess, as a sort of a partial response that might be slightly more satisfactory than that one, is that I guess one of the concerns here is that when you've got half of the mortgage loans still underwater, and when you've got, you know, differing sort of dates at which particular mortgages could end up going delinquent, or there might be resets of one kind or another, I guess the principal concern is the idea of a multiplicity of sudden delinquencies or defaults all at one time, which could suddenly glut that market. But again, you're better situated to know what the prospect of something like that's happening
is. I mean,
and of course, so is the city of San Bernardino. And you guys would, you know, obviously you guys differ on that, and I'm probably not fit to sort of adjudicate or take sides on that one.
Well, what you're suggesting happened in 08 and 09, no doubt about it. I mean, you had more foreclosures than you had sales. That's
exactly.
Never remotely happened before. But now foreclosures are down by two-thirds,
right.
And the demand is coming back in the market. Let's set that aside for the time being, and let's talk about the plan that your memorandum suggests, and you know, and kind of talk about what type of inventory it's going to be helpful for, and what type of inventory it's not going to deal with. Okay.
Right. Sure. So maybe the best way to kind of focus that particular discussion, I think, is to basically make reference to this idea of a collective action problem that I talk about at some length in that particular memorandum that you've kindly read, right? So the operating theory here is that, you know, there are, of course, first of all, you've got a class of underwater mortgage loans, which are subject then to significant default risk. Second of all, you know, some of these loans are more underwater than others and thus more subject to default risk than are others. That means that there are some, you know, underwater mortgage loans in respect of which you can actually increase the so-called expected values or EVs if you write down principal, and other ones in which you won't increase the EVs if you write down principal. The question then becomes, all right, well then, is there some mechanism pursuant to which all and only those loans whose EVs can be increased by writing down principal will end up being modified and written down or sold to somebody else who can do that by those who currently hold them? Well, there is such a mechanism when we're talking about portfolio loans, right? So if you've got a banking institution that actually holds the loans that originated or for some other reason, owing to some other history, owns whole loans rather than just mortgage-backed securities that are tied to fragmentary interest in pools of loans, in cases like that, what you see going on is a great deal of modification, a great deal of principal write-downs, right? I think that Laurie Goodman over at Amherst Securities, who does a lot of the best empirical work on this stuff, has that rate up at somewhere around 25% now. It's a rather surprisingly high rate, or at least initially surprisingly high rate, at which the portfolio loan holders are writing down principal on some of the loans, right? Obviously not all of them, but the ones whose EVs can, in theory, be maximized or raised by write-downs. Now, what's really interesting is if you compare write-downs in that case to write-downs in the case of the private label securitized mortgage pools, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in those cases, the write-down rates are much, much lower, just unbelievably lower. And the question then becomes, well, is that because it's less financially rational for the securitized mortgage trusts to do that than it is for the portfolio loan holders to do it, or is there some other reason? There doesn't seem to be any financially rational reason for the PLSAs not to do this. And indeed, in fact, it turns out that there's a mechanical reason for it. And it's basically that most of these trusts have been formed pursuant to so-called PSAs, pooling and servicing agreements, contracts of a kind, that were formulated during the bubble years when lots of people seem to have been operating under the misapprehension that real estate prices can only go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so they didn't provide for write-downs or sell-offs of underwater loans by the servicers. So they're sort of standing in the way of, in those cases, they're standing in the way of the servicers doing what is actually in the financial best interest of the bondholders themselves. So we view this, people I've talked to about this, and I have been pushing this idea for, again, about 4 years or so, this is a classic collective action problem, a classic creditor collective action problem, but one that's sort of on steroids, in effect. So the question then becomes, how can we deal with that problem, you know, given these kind of Frankenstein contracts that are currently operating as sort of suicide pacts, in effect, because they were just written at a time when people weren't thinking about what could happen market-wide.
Let me just ask a specific question right here that's probably pertinent. You're basically saying that the way it's structured, it gets in the way of a loan modification. Does it get in the way of a foreclosure process?
It doesn't get in the way of the foreclosure process.
Okay.
But foreclosure processes are always very costly, nevertheless, as you know, and they take a long time because there are all sorts of legal procedural safeguards that we put in place before we allow people simply to be thrown out of their homes, right? So it doesn't prevent foreclosures, but it does prevent financially rational write-downs and sales of loans. And indeed, if you think about it, it's a market impediment insofar as it does that, right? Because one of the things that markets do best, of course, is to price and reprice various assets in response to changing facts on the ground, right? So, if mortgage loans suddenly become less valuable owing to heightened default risk, owing in turn to underwater status, markets typically, when they can, will respond by bringing about or facilitating write-downs in cases where that's value maximizing, and foreclosures in cases where that's what's value maximizing. And the point is that you got different loans are differently, you know, different loans are value, are different kinds of effect or different responses to different loans are value maximizing, right? And so in many cases, the modifications or the sales of the loans is value maximizing, and in other cases, the foreclosures are. But the thing is that when the portfolio loans are written down at much higher rates than the securitized loans are, and when you can attribute the lack of write-downs in the securitization case to these PSAs, right, these toxic contracts, there's a good argument to, you know, there's a good reason to suspect that essentially we've got a market failure underway here, a market impediment. And one way of looking at the use of eminent domain here is it's simply a very straightforward way of getting around that particular contract impediment. If, in other words, you choose the right mortgage loans, namely the very ones that it would be financially rational to write down, then what you're essentially doing, and you use eminent domain then to go ahead and buy those at a fair value, what you're essentially doing is recouping a particular increment of value that is currently lost owing to a market failure. And then if you wisely and, you know, Solomonically distribute that particular increment of recouped value over all relevant stakeholders, you can literally have a situation in which everybody wins, right? So you get the first lien holders, of course, get money for a currently unmarketable asset, and it's non-marketable again because of these problematic contracts.
They could foreclose on it, though. They can't sell it or they can't reduce it, but they could foreclose on it. Is that
correct?
Yeah,
but the point is it's value maximizing. If you choose the loans properly, it's actually more valuable. It's value maximizing for the bondholders to modify or to sell to somebody who can modify than it is to foreclose, because foreclosure is a very expensive process in its own right, and it takes a long time as well.
Well, in California, it isn't expensive. It honestly just isn't. It's by statute, and it depends on the loan size, and the time frame is 3 months and 45 days. So But that has twists and turns and legal problems now that we've had such a big problem. Those rules have changed. So I'll grant you that.
Right.
Different.
But and again, the fundamental point is that, yeah, there are some loans where the value-maximizing solution is to foreclose, and there are other loans where the value-maximizing solution is to sell or modify, right? What? Modify or sell those. That's the principal point. And one can disagree as to what the relative numbers of loans in each category are, but the basic point is that, nevertheless, there are both categories. And if one chooses loans from the correct category, namely those in respect of which value is indeed maximized by selling or writing down, if one chooses those, then eminent domain itself is value maximizing for everybody, right? Again, provided that increment of recouped value is distributed Solomonically, which can be done.
Let's talk about then the type of loan that you're suggesting eminent domain be used on. It's very specific. It's the loan is probably current at this point. Is that still correct?
Yes.
Okay.
At present, that's the version of the plan that I understand San Bernardino to be considering. Right.
That the loan, if it's so, this isn't really somebody in foreclosure or somebody that's about to get evicted. This has nothing in the plan helps them. This is somebody that's maybe living next door that's making a payment on an over encumbered home, and the reason the public purpose is that person, even though they're current, 4 years after the downturn, are more likely to become a foreclosure in the future. Is that?
Yeah, that's the basic idea. Yeah.
Okay.
And the reason for choosing those in particular, right? So basically, I think of it this way. You can think of a sort of a larger class and then a subclass within the larger class. The larger class is that of underwater mortgage loans, all of which are subject to very high default risk. Then you look at the subclass of those underwater mortgage loans that are subject to high default risk but that have not defaulted yet. One reason for beginning, at least, with that subclass of the broader class of at-risk of default underwater mortgage loans is because that subclass involves no possible moral hazard problem, right? You're essentially rewarding people who have remained current notwithstanding all the odds, right? And notwithstanding, of course, the lower expected value of their loans precisely by dint of the statistical correlation between underwater status on the one hand and default likelihood on the other hand.
Well, you know, and that I'm a lender, so, you know, that one gets at the heart of let's just use some figures. And, you know, this is where a problem comes in on an appraisal value.
Uh-huh.
You got a 200 grand loan on a house in San Bernardino now worth 100, but it's perfectly current and it's at 5% interest instead of the current market of 3.5%. Mm-hmm. And the goal was for that loan to be bought at less than the house value because of its likelihood of default. Isn't that true? Is that the idea? There's a margin there between the 100 and what's the loan going to be purchased. I don't know how you'll have that loan appraised for less. How do you determine value of something that's current and performing?
Right, right. So the basic answer to that question is sort of we have a valuation method or valuation methodology that San Bernardino is considering using. We believe that it will hold up in court because we believe it's a sound valuation methodology that's based on canonical, well-known, well-accepted orthodox valuation methods. But the further details of that methodology for the time being at least remain proprietary. So I'm sort of not at liberty to give, you know, to sort of specify the valuation model itself.
Okay.
But the basic point, I suppose, the punchline of it is that, you know, provided that it's a plausible model that we're using, we really are talking about mortgage loans that are worth very little, notwithstanding their current status, precisely by dint of the degree to which they are underwater, right? Very high LTVs.
Robert, let's go ahead and end this segment right now, and that way we'll have time to talk a little bit about more so you're not feeling rushed, okay?
Oh, okay. Yeah,
we've been
sure.
with Robert Hockett, author of It Takes a Village. It's a fascinating memorandum, and I enjoy reading it, even though I disagreed with some of it.
Right.
All right. Thanks for joining us.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.